The world was in turmoil after World War II, and the Cold War was a daily reminder that while open hostilities had ended, the situation could change in the blink of an eye. And one of the arenas in which the United States and the Soviet Union were competing was the space race. Hello, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to learn about one of the fascinating stories from that period of history from George Morgan. George has a degree in creative writing from Cal State Channel Islands and is working on a Master's of Fine Arts in writing for the performing arts through the University of California, Riverside. George has written more than a dozen stage plays and musicals and is currently the playwright in residence at Caltech. He's the author of Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist, which is also the story of his mother. George Morgan, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Hi, Judith. How are you doing?
Doing well. And I have to say, your book is fascinating.
Thank you.
It's really gripping, and it's gripping both from that national and international history level, and also, you know, it's really your story and the story of your family and trying to kind of make sense of your relationship with your mother. I'd actually like to start out, George, by having you read that first paragraph of Rocket Girl, because I really think it sets the stage so perfectly. Can you read that for us?
Sure, I'd be glad to. This is a story about a mother who never talked to her children. This is a story about a wife who rarely talked to her husband, though they were married for 53 years. This is a story of a woman who desperately wanted happiness, but could never summon the strength to reach for it. This is a story of a woman who had a family that loved her, but who struggled to love them in return. This is a story about a woman whom people admired, but could never get close to. This is a story of a woman who harbored many secrets and lived in daily fear that those secrets would one day be revealed. This is a story of a woman who took those secrets to her grave. This is a story about America's first female rocket scientist. This is a story about my mother.
And as I said, I think that just really beautifully sums up the book and your search. I mean, this is really, you know, there's a quest on the level of nations trying to be preeminent in the space race, but this is also a quest of you trying to make sense of that woman who, while she was your mother, was really also a mystery to you.
I'd say mystery is an understatement. It's kind of strange being the son of two rocket scientists. It was a kind of an unusual upbringing, to say the least.
I can only imagine.
And both of my parents were under the gun by their employers to never speak of any of their work. But even after their work was declassified, my mother would never speak about anything she ever did in the aerospace business, and nor would she speak about any part of her life, including growing up on a farm in North Dakota. So, you know, when someone won't talk to anyone about their lives, they become a big mystery, and that's what she was.
Well, and as you say, you really knew just the general outline of your mother's life while she was alive. It was really after her death and your father asking you to write her obituary that you took on the research in earnest, and it turned out to be much less straightforward than it sounds like you expected.
It's kind of ironic that you have to write an obituary about a parent to really learn something about them, but that's kind of what happened. I actually had to interview my father about my mother's life to be able to write that obituary, and then I had the shock of having it turned down by the Los Angeles Times. They refused to print it on the grounds they couldn't verify any of the information in it. They couldn't verify even... The lady at the LA Times told me, "We can't even verify that your mother ever existed." That's how much of a mystery woman she'd become.
And so how did you start? You know, you thought, I'll write this obituary, I'll submit it. Of course, it will be published because, you know, she obviously played a very significant role. And yet there was no record of this. And as you dug into it, it seems like it felt more like, well, it's not that this wasn't noted, it's that this has actually been intentionally hidden. And I think for anyone, that would pique your curiosity even more.
I think much of her life has been intentionally hidden, but she's the one who did most of that hiding herself. She was a very, very private person. She invented the rocket fuel that launched America's first satellite, Explorer 1, into orbit. And right afterwards, she got a phone call at work from a reporter from Life magazine, which at that time, the Life magazine was the number one magazine in America, even though it's not around anymore. And she told the reporter that if he wrote a story about her, she would sue the magazine, and then she hung up on him.
Wow.
So she's been written out of the history books that she should have been in. But the reality is she did a lot of that unwriting herself.
Right. In a lot of ways, she was the one editing herself out of the history.
That's true. You know, it's hard for us to understand that in a celebrity-obsessed world like what we live in. And I think that really is the kind of world we live in. It's celebrity-obsessed. And she was just the opposite of that. She hated celebrities. She hated the whole idea of celebrity. And she did not want her name in the magazines or the paper, the media, at all. She was just very, very private like that.
We are talking with George Morgan. He is the author of Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist, which is also the story of his mother. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. Do you remember those years of the Cold War and the space race? What memories do you have of that period in American and really international history? We'd love to have you join us. So, George, you did mention that your mother grew up on a farm in North Dakota. She had, to say the very least, a difficult childhood. Give us a sense of those early years of Mary Sherman Morgan.
My mother always wanted to go to school. From her earliest recollections, from when she was a very small child, she wanted to go to school, but as often happens in rural farm life, especially after the turn of the century, her parents wanted her to work on the farm, to milk cows and do farm work rather than go to school. And so my grandfather kept her out of school till she was 9 years old, and the state of North Dakota had to step in and literally force him to enroll her in school under threat of arrest. Because there was a river between the farmhouse and the school, the state of North Dakota gave her a horse that she could ride each day to go to the schoolhouse.
Wow.
And pretty amazing. And she had it very rough because not only did she have to go to school then, after, of course, she was happy to do that, but when she got home, she would still have to do her 8 or 10 or 12 hours of farm chores. Her father wouldn't let her off the hook to do less work just because she was going to school now. So it was very hard life, and it was during the Depression to make things even worse.
Well, and what's interesting too is I remember, it's towards the end of the book that you say actually even those facts were to a certain extent called into question because other people's version of that childhood was different. So even really pretty basic facts you had a hard time verifying.
Yes, finding out facts about my mother has been difficult. I guess you know, it's probably not that unusual that a small farm in a remote corner of North Dakota would not keep good records. There's no photographic records of my mother or her siblings growing up. There's no written information about any of the members of the family except a few birth certificates on some of them. It's a very spotty record, and so it was very difficult to find out facts about her life growing up. And in fact, 90% of what I ended up finding out, which is in the book, was done by my daughter Carly. Even though my mother would never talk to me or my siblings, my wife suggested one day sending her granddaughter, my daughter Carly, to go interview her. And my mother said, sure, come on over. And she spilled her guts to my daughter.
Wow.
Spent 2 hours being interviewed by my daughter. I mean, I couldn't get 2 hours worth of information on my mother in my whole life.
Wow.
And yet, to her granddaughter, she was only too happy to talk about farm life.
Wow.
So that was a big coup.
So it's, I mean, the story of any woman who became the first female rocket scientist would be fascinating and probably in some ways unlikely because they would be a trailblazer. But it seems like that very difficult childhood and being held back from education until, you know, much later than most children, it's even less likely that your mother would rise out of that to become this preeminent rocket scientist. What was her first exposure to chemistry and science?
She had a teacher who understood a little bit, we're talking about elementary school mm-hmm. now, in the one-room schoolhouse she attended up through eighth grade. She had a teacher who had some basic knowledge about chemistry and kind of piqued her interest in it by doing some minor chemistry experiments in class. And that just kind of got her interested, and she wanted to know more and started studying more. When she went to high school, she went to a much bigger school. Once she got to high school, she had 50 people in her graduating class. And even though she started school 3 years late, she graduated from high school as her class valedictorian. And it was in high school that she took every bit of chemistry that she could get her hands on and just kind of grew from there. But the thing that really kind of shot her to the top of knowledge in chemistry was World War II. When World War II broke out, she had to leave college. She had been in college for a short while. She was recruited to work at a chemical plant that made weapons like TNT and such things like that for the World War II effort. And she just kind of cut her teeth on the job working for this company in Ohio. It's called Pembroke Ordnance. And so she, even though she didn't have a degree in chemistry, she learned on the job during the war.
And it was very kind of cloak and dagger. She was set up with an interview for the job by the priest that was the head of the college that she was going to. And he couldn't say what it was about. And the person that met her on a street corner couldn't say what it was about until,
right,
I mean,
right.
Very, very Cold War espionage.
Very Cold Warish and cloak and daggers. A stranger comes up to her on the street one day. She's on her way to class, got an armful of textbooks. And the stranger comes up to her and recruits her to work for Pembroke Ordnance. She didn't want to quit. She didn't want to quit school, but he kind of guilt-tripped her into this, saying, "No, that your country needs you. Give her the your country needs you speech." And my mother has always been very patriotic, and she decided to quit school. And if my country needs me, then here I am. I think that one of the things that's really been interesting that I've uncovered researching my mother's life is that we know a lot about the existence of these blue-collar Rosie the Riveters during World War II. What I was surprised to find out was that there were also so many white-collar Rosie the Riveters, women who worked in white-collar science and engineering jobs, too, which were also, they also had a shortage of during the war. You don't hear as much about that, but basically that's what my mother was as a chemist for this company. She was kind of like a white-collar Rosie the Riveter.
And we should say that your mother did go to college, and it was during college that she got this job at Pembroke Ordnance Works. But her path, just like her path through school, was not typical. Her path to college was not typical. She actually escaped in the middle of the night from her hometown to go to college.
Right. She suspected that her father would want her to go back to working on the farm even more hours once she graduated from high school. So a few months before graduation, she surreptitiously started planning an escape from the farm. She enrolled in a college, and she used the local Catholic parish as an address drop for paperwork back and forth. And she basically, the night of her graduation from high school, she quietly, secretly got on a bus out of town and drove to Ohio and went to this little Catholic college called DeSales College, which doesn't exist anymore. You know, so much of my mother's life is so mysterious. Even the college that she went to doesn't exist anymore.
It's like by association, things get buried in history.
Yeah, everything she touches appears. Kind of funny.
Well, we are visiting with George Morgan. He has written more than a dozen stage plays and musicals. He's currently the playwright in residence at Caltech, and he's the author of Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist. It's also the story of his mother. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Miller. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Were you alive during the Cold War space race? What do you remember about those times? What was the atmosphere? And how invested was the American public in dominating space in the Cold War? We'd love to have you join us. Marika Suval, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're learning about the fascinating story told in Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist. The author and her son is George Morgan, and he's joining us today. Well, George, certainly, you know, you focus on your mother's work and the work being done on the U.S. side in the Cold War and the space race, but you also tell the stories of a Russian scientist and a German one, kind of parallel lines. Tell us about Sergei Korolev and Wernher von Braun.
Right. Sergei Korolev and Wernher von Braun were two sides of the same coin. These men, both independently of each other on opposite sides of the world, had the same dream. They wanted to build a rocket and go to the moon. And they used their government's money to try to lay the foundation of the fulfillment of their dreams. Von Braun in Germany and Sergei Korolev in the Soviet Union. And what I do in the book is I kind of go back and forth showing little vignettes of these men as they are building their country's rocket programs and use my mother's progress in America as kind of a counterbeat to show how all three of these people are going to kind of coalesce on the world stage together. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, and I think it is interesting because there are, you know, we think of these nations as being, you know, locked in this race and in this struggle for preeminence. But really, when you get right down to it, it's all about those individuals like Korolev and von Braun and your mother. And the interesting thing, I think, is that Wernher von Braun ends up coming to the U.S. and working on these issues. And how did this passel of German rocket scientists end up in Texas, of all places?
Well, they basically, first of all, the German scientists surrendered to the Americans shortly after Adolf Hitler committed suicide. The Germans knew that it was inevitable they would end up in the hands of either the Russian army or the American army, or the Allied army, and they were pretty certain that the best army to end up in the hands of would have been the Allies. So Wernher von Braun sent his brother down the mountain from their hideout to surrender to the Allied armies. And then the U.S. Army brought them to America in a secret program called Project Paperclip. And because the United States government wanted to avoid a scandal of bringing 105 former Nazis to American soil, they were certain would probably cause some political problems. This was done in very secret manner, and they put them in this little out of the way place, you know, hundreds of miles from anywhere, called Fort Sill in western Texas. And the U.S. Army put these 105 German scientists to work, basically building ICBMs, the Redstone rocket, which they worked on in Texas and in New Mexico at the White Sands Proving Grounds, was one of the first ICBMs designed to carry atomic warheads.
And ICBMs are intercontinental ballistic missiles, correct?
Right. Which was the weapon of the Cold War. You know, people lived in fear during the Cold War. Why? Because they were afraid that a rocket with an atomic warhead would fall fall on their heads any moment from the Soviet Union. Both countries were building ICBMs, and both countries were preparing to design them with atomic warheads. So it was a very scary time. I was in grade school during this period of time, and every Friday at 10 o'clock in the morning, the sirens in Los Angeles would wail, and we'd all jump underneath our desks for several minutes. The old duck and cover drill. I was in the thick of duck and cover growing up. I remember it very well. So this was a time of great fear in America. I think the thing to stress, though, is that scientists like Sergei Korolev and Wernher von Braun, these are men who had no desire, really, to build weapons at all. Mm-hmm. These guys hated building weapons. They were dreamers. They just wanted to build a rocket and fly to the moon. That's what they really wanted to do. But all the people that had money, in other words, governments, kept putting them to the task of building weapons, and they all hated it. So eventually, Wernher von Braun got out of the weapons business and helped get our nation to the moon. He was in charge of the Apollo program.
Well, and there were people like your mother who, you know, the way that you portray her is really, you know, this driving curiosity and, you know, she wanted to solve those formulas. She wanted to, you know, increase the capacity of fuels. It seemed like for your mother, it wasn't even about that passion for, you know, building a rocket and getting to the moon. It was really solving this puzzle.
Yeah, for my mother, working in the aerospace business was more of an intellectual challenge. She just loved intellectual challenges. Whether someone wanted to help have her help them build a rocket to the moon, or whether she was playing a game of Trivial Pursuit or playing bridge, it didn't matter. She wanted her days filled with intellectual challenges, and she didn't have this glorified dream like von Braun did with going to the moon. That really didn't really mean anything to her. But she was highly intelligent. I mentioned Trivial Pursuit, I should tell you this little anecdote. When the game Trivial Pursuit first came out, I bought her a game, and we played it that very night, and she slaughtered everybody. We had about six people at the table. And nobody else got to play because she knew the answers to all the questions in all the categories.
Which is fascinating because often the stereotype is that scientists know their area of science and that's about it. But it sounds like she knew a whole lot more than that.
In fact, I'll never forget the final question that she won the game on was some obscure question about boxing. And I'm looking around and I said, how is it that she knows that question about boxing? Mom doesn't follow boxing. How does she even know that? So that's the kind of person she was. She was just extremely intellectual and smart.
Well, and another mystery, how your mother knew
about
boxing.
There. How does she know about boxing? There you go. Every 5 minutes, I get another mystery.
George Morgan is the author of Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist, who was also his mother. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post a question or comment on our Facebook page. Were you part of that duck and cover generation? Do you remember living through the Cold War and the space race? What are your memories of that period? We'd love to have you join in. So, George, we have Wernher von Braun and his team of, you know, crack German rocket scientists working in Texas for the U.S. government, but they are having a problem with the fuel, and it turns out that your mother is crucial to their success. What was it that they set her on to work on?
Okay, so at that time, in the United States, there were two rocket programs going on simultaneously. There was the U.S. Army and Wernher von Braun building the ICBM in Texas, known as the Redstone. And concurrently with that, there was the Vanguard project out in Florida and other parts of the country, a program administered by the U.S. Navy whose sole purpose was to launch the world's first satellite into orbit. And the Vanguard program is going very poorly. Many people have probably seen on old newsreels photographs of it collapsing and blowing up on the launch pad. It was having one problem after another. The reason it was having so many problems is because in America at that time, the only people who really knew how to build a rocket were the Germans. And the Germans were not being allowed to work on this civilian Vanguard program. So everybody that was working on that program, they were all newbies. They were all new at the rocket business, and they were living through the mistakes, having to live through all the mistakes that von Braun and his scientists had already gone through 10 or 20 years before. So von Braun was very frustrated about this because he knew that he could put a rocket in orbit if the U.S. government would just let him. But for political reasons, Dwight D. Eisenhower and his administration had put the German scientists on a leash. They didn't want these Germans, these former Nazis, to do anything that had any notoriety, anything
sure.
that might be put them in the news on the headlines, like putting a rocket in orbit.
Right. Well, and basically that would have gone against all of the anti-Nazi propaganda that the U.S. had put out during World War II
right.
to then kind
it
of
was,
turn it over
right.
to them.
Right. It was highly politicized. It's, I can't think of a similar situation compared to today, but you can just imagine it was highly politicized. So, one day everything changed. And the thing that changed was Sergei Korolev and his team in the Soviet Union successfully launched Sputnik. Toward the end of 1957, I think it was around December, it was October of 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the world's first satellite. And now America is angry because if Americans hate one thing more than any other, they hate being number two in anything.
Especially to the Soviet Union.
especially to a communist country like the Soviet mm-hmm. Union. So Americans were mad. They were also frightened because now they knew that the Soviet Union, which had the atom bomb, could drop an atom bomb, had the ability, the lifting capacity and rocketry to drop an atom bomb anywhere in the country, anywhere they wanted to. So they were angry for being number two. They were angry because they were living in fear. So Dwight D. Eisenhower, overnight, the whole political situation changed, and he decided to take the leash off of the Germans and let Wernher von Braun and his team try to launch a rocket in orbit. However, von Braun had an unspoken problem that he hadn't told anybody about, and that's that all of his bravado, bragging that he could put the Redstone into orbit, turned out not to be true. The Redstone rocket did not have enough lifting capacity to put a satellite into orbit. They needed to increase the performance by about 7%. It did not quite have as much power as necessary to get into orbit. So they needed a more powerful fuel to boost its performance by 7%. Now, picture this. You've got 105 of the very best rocket scientists who have ever lived, and they can't figure out, they can't come up with a better fuel to give them that 7% of extra performance. So what do? They put the monkey on somebody else's back. They give a contract to North American Aviation, who was the company that built their booster for the Redstone. They said, here, the problem, we're going to give this problem to you. We need a new fuel that will boost our performance 7%. We don't want to have to change one nut or bolt in the rocket's design. It's got to work with the existing hardware, the existing design, and boost performance 7%.
And that would be a pretty tall order.
That was a tall order, very tall order, because building a rocket is like building a car. If you design an engine for diesel, you got to put diesel in it. Design it for gas, got to put gas in it. So here they were in a situation where North America was being told they had to put a different fuel in it that would also increase the performance. Well, they had, they understood right away why the Germans had put the monkey on their back, because it seemed impossible. But they had to, there was money at stake. The contract had money attached to it, and they wanted to do their best. And they certainly wanted to help America get into orbit and save its Sputnik besmudged reputation. So they gave the contract to their very best rocket propellant scientist.
Which was your mother.
My mother, who had nothing more in her wall than a high school diploma at that point. In fact, she never did graduate from college. So a farm girl from North Dakota with nothing more on her wall than a high school diploma was being asked to succeed, where the Germans and their brilliance and their education, their experience had all failed.
And she succeeded.
And she succeeded. She spent about 3 months working on it. She had a couple of other employees fresh out of college, Bill Weber and a Japanese man named Toru Shimizu, who had spent his previous few years in Manzanar in a Japanese internment camp during the war. These men had just gotten out of college with their master's degrees, and they in chemical engineering. And my mother was assigned a few of these engineers to work with her. And after a few months, they decided that there was no molecule that they could create, no new chemical that they could create that would come up and satisfy this contract. So my mother suggested, well, why don't we try a cocktail? Now, without getting too technical, in the rocket business, a cocktail is a mixture of two other rocket propellants, whereby sometimes they become greater than the sum of their parts. You can get more performance by mixing two together than you would with either one separately. So they started looking around for various combinations. What if we mix this with that, mix that with that? And they finally came up with one single solution. Hold on to your tongue. I'm going to pronounce these chemicals. A mixture of unsymmetrical dimethyl hydrazine and diethylene triamine, two very exotic, unusual chemicals. They figured out if they mixed them at a 60-40 percentage, it would boost performance of the Redstone by 10%, even more than was required by the contract. And they mixed up a batch of it, and eventually Explorer 1, on its very first attempt, went into orbit.
Wow. And so when the U.S. did put this rocket up, it was really Wernher von Braun who was kind of the face of the project. Your mother was not part of that, you know, kind of celebratory, congratulatory event. Right. Do you think that's partly sexism at work? Is it partly your mother wanting to stay behind? What do you think drove that?
Well, when she first went to work at North American, she was the only woman doing engineering work out of 900 engineers. I don't know. I can't even imagine what a room full of 900 engineers with one female engineer would even look like. It's just, and I think, according to my father, he says that my mother did, in fact, experience sexism and those kinds of problems at work often, and it upset her a great deal. The problem is that there was no outlet or medium for those kind of complaints to be surfaced in those days. It's not like today. If you have a sexual harassment complaint, there's an established method of complaining about it. Back then, there was absolutely nothing. But yeah, she did have some problems in that regard. But I think we need to give credit where credit is due. North American Aviation, they recognized that despite the fact she was the only woman in the company in that division, she was also the best at what she did, and that was coming up with new rocket propellants. And woman or not, the fact that she was the best meant she got the job. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is something they need to be given credit for.
And your mother actually leaves her job when she's going to be a mother for the second time. I mean, this has really been, you know, her life's fulfillment is doing this work. What do you think that meant for her as a human being to leave the work that she loved for this family that, by your reckoning, she was not a very warm mother?
Well, what did it mean to leave?
What do you think it meant to her to leave the work that she loved because of her family?
Well, the reality is, I think she always regretted it. I think if we could turn the clock back and she could do her life all over again, I think she just would have had all of us kids babysat. She would have continued to go to work, because I know she always missed it. She always missed going to the action of the aerospace business. I mean, that was the dawn of the space age. After Redstone, our country had one fantastic headline success after another after another, and she missed out on all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think she spent her life regretting having left it. I mean, I admire her that she decided to raise us as a full-time mother. You know, thank you, Mom. That was very mm-hmm. generous of you. But the truth of the matter is, I know she lived with some regrets for having done that.
You also are very kind to her in retrospect, I think, because you realize that she was probably dealing with some mental health issues along the way as well.
Yes, and because she never talked about herself, that means she never talked about mental issues and medical issues especially. And so we've always kind of assumed that whatever her problem was undiagnosed. She mm-hmm. never really, probably never got a diagnosis of it. But she had a lot of OCD-type behavioral behaviors that we noticed over the years. Mm-hmm. I'm not even remotely qualified to talk about this subject, but she obviously had some sort of mental issues, which may have contributed to the fact that she had to leave the aerospace business. They weren't severe. I mean, she was able to, you know, function like any normal person. You know,
well, and, quite a bit better than the average person, considering her accomplishments.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were debilitating. It wasn't a debilitating illness, but it did affect her day-to-day behaviors. Which sometimes for us kids growing up got a little bit scary once in a while. But, you know, she lived through this era where people didn't talk about their medical problems.
Right.
And she never talked about hers. And so to this day, nobody, including my father, even knows what she had.
Wow. Well, George Morgan, thank you so much for spending the time with us today and for sharing the story of your mother.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
George Morgan is the author of Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist. Mary Sherman Morgan was also his mother. And what a fascinating story. George Morgan really had to do a lot of digging to bring his mother's legacy to light. Coming up next, we're going to find out how each and every one of us can leave a legacy of our own through charitable giving. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. I hope you'll stay with us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.